Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Hi, Mormon Matters listeners. Dan here again. This is the third in our series of releases today with short interviews of various people with wonderful perspectives in life and Mormonism in general, and bringing those to bear as much as they can or they're able to at this early stage in the story on the pending actions and church discipline that's hanging over the head of Kate and John and Alan Ruckwaterman and others. So this interview is with Christine Haglund. Everyone will know Christine as somebody who's been on this show a lot of times, but her bigger claims to fame is as an amazing, important blogger for many years in the Bloggernacle, and then the last 6 or 7 years as the editor of Dialogue. And from that platform, she's also become quite a national voice, a go-to person for lots of different stories and whatnot. So she's brilliant, and she offers a wonderful take here on institutional structures and how some of those things might have fed into the church deciding to take the action that they have. We'll now join our conversation with Christine. I'm with Christine Haglund now. I'm so grateful for you joining me, Christine. You guys, it's so funny, everyone. I generally, get people a few days or weeks in advance, and today I'm catching a lot of people with just their cell phones with just these short minutes to give me. But Christine, thanks for joining us today from your cell in Massachusetts.
Sure. Glad to be here.
We're staying away as much as we can. We don't know all the information about what caused all this, but let's just talk some different angles. And you've shared some interesting framings with me about, without going into the details of John and Kate and situation like that. I would love to hear a framing or anything that you would like to share with Mormon Matters listeners that would sort of broaden the perspective. We're all kind of sitting here reeling, and we're sad and feeling the tent close, the world is shrinking, yeah, and all that stuff. But let's go new angles as much as we can. So wherever do you want to start?
Well, let me start with the caveat that I am not a quick thinker. I'm slow, and it will probably take me months to know what I actually think about this, so I want to reserve the right to disagree with myself in the future.
Nice, nice.
And I'm almost certain that I will. But as I've sort of tried to think my way out of the immediate morass of just sick sadness, I've been thinking a lot about this as a structural problem. And what I mean by that, I actually, of all the places for inspiration to come from, I was thinking of the title of a Lit Crit book by Frederick Jameson that everybody used to have to read a million years ago when I was in grad school, called Postmodernism or the Cultural Logic of Late Capitalism. And it's one of those books where the title
one.
Is
yeah.
Actually, the title's probably better than the book, or tells you, it's sort of the most revealing thing. But I'm been thinking about this as the cultural logic of late correlation.
Ah.
That is, the system of correlation served really important purposes for the 20th century church and made it possible for the church to grow in ways that it probably couldn't have without that animating structure. And so in lots of ways, I think that's been a really good thing for the church to have the system of streamlining that's made things more efficient and made it possible to translate basic doctrinal materials into lots of languages and make some consistency of doctrine across a really, you know, crazy sprawling church that could easily have fractured into a million pieces at any dozens of points in its history. The problem with the structure, and especially with the structure sort of only that moves always from sort of a thick center to a thin periphery, is that to make a structure like that strong, you end up making it kind of brittle too. And that means that at the edges, it's fragile. And the way that I think that kind of structural thinking applies to this moment is that there's no mechanism in the structure for meaningful feedback from periphery to center. And so, you know, the farther out you move from the center, and in this case, that means the farther out you move from being a white man older than 60 who lives in Utah, the more different you are, the more different your experience is from that. You know, the thinner really the connecting thread to the center gets, and, you know, those brittle threads can break off. Mm-hmm. And the other thing about brittle things when they break is that they send shards and splinters flying all over the place, and there's a lot of collateral damage that, you know, is unfortunate and you know, hopefully unnecessary if you think of a better way to build things. So anyway, I think that the impossibility of truly different perspectives informing the information that's coming from the center or place means that this kind of stuff is going to keep happening. And it has happened, you know, throughout the 20th century. You see it in the 30s over evolution, and then again in the 50s over the origin of man and Joseph Sutton Smith's views, and you see it over Mormon doctrine, and you see it over the ERA. And, you know, I mean, it's this cycle. When you get to those edge points that are different from the center in important ideological or cultural ways, you know, there's not a good way to incorporate them into a sturdy and flexible structure if it's just a one directional sort of, I don't know, I'm thinking of like a wand, you know, sort of stretches from Salt Lake to outward, but never, you know, curls around back in or has supporting structures elsewhere. It's fragile.
And keep going on this, because this is super insightful. But by calling it late correlation, are you also somewhat thinking it's at the breaking point, or it's about to collapse, or are you just is this a panic mode from those leaders who maybe recognize this but don't know any other system to try to put in place instead?
You trying to call me Cassandra?
Oh, yeah. No one will believe you either.
No,
so that's you can see the future, but none of us will believe you.
I don't know. I think I have a little more faith and optimism than that. Don't tell my Swedish ancestors that I'm pretending to faith and optimism, but there is definitely some element of fear, but I think it's just growth. You know, we're just at a point where we sort of did all the growing that correlation would allow us to do, and that seems to be slowing down, and we haven't quite figured out what's next. And my sense has been that it will be the unwinding of that correlation process that we need to figure out how to devolve some control and some cultural some cultural license to the periphery from the center.
Right.
You know, to allow for more regional variation and for more diversity of voices. I think the need for this is clearly seen by many people. I think the I'm a Mormon campaign was an obvious manifestation of that sense that diversity could in fact be something that is good for the church and necessary for its growth, you know, that figuring out how to not just allow but even celebrate diversity among the membership is a way to reach out to more kinds of people than we've traditionally, you know, been able to reach in our you know, post-correlation missionary efforts. But you know, I don't think that vision is uniformly shared among the brethren. I think probably, you know, there's a bunch of smart, opinionated men who all have different experiences and you know, bring those experiences to bear in different ways. And I think they're figuring it out as they go too, which is what they're supposed to do.
Yeah. But do you think this is driven by a pragmatism, like, at all on their part of, well, if we can get a dampening effect, you know, and you and I can go a little bit historical here, knowing, you know, the history from the 20 years of the other. Do you think that's kind of, they just want to have it calmed down right now while they figure out how to give more out to the edges? Or is this just like, no, we are doubling down on correlation, we're doubling down on a central leadership, and, you know, this is, Jan Shipps used the line, it's boundary maintenance move, you know, in her, in the Tribune quote. You know, they're just going to pick a couple of people, or who knows if there's more. I mean, we've now heard of Alan Rock Waterman being called in. It doesn't quite feel like the same thing to me because he hasn't officially been notified, you know, of the action happening. But anyway, I guess I'm just trying to get a sense of, from you of, are they confused? Again, we're a total tea leaf reader here, and we reserve the right to back off of it. But is it just the noise has been so loud from ordained women? The GLBT stuff is so loud that they picked a target in each area.
Well, you know, when they call me for advice,
I'm on speed dial.
I'm totally kidding. I mean, I don't have insight there, and I'm not quite cynical enough to think that this is coldly calculated in that way. I'm sure that on some level they are just scared and you know, would like it to quiet down. That makes perfect sense to me. And in fact, you know, that makes perfect sense to me as a parent with opinionated children.
Yes,
you know, there are times when if I could just get one of them to shut up for a little while, you know, and it's not that I don't love that child or that I don't want to include that child in my plans. It's that, you know, yeah, there is some practical necessity for just please going along to get along. And I, you know, I can understand how frustrating that might be. And I am not an easy child either. I can appreciate that. But I think it's not knowing people. I think that these people are so far removed. I find it really hard to imagine sitting down in a room with Kate Kelly and coming away, you know, and talking to her for any length of time and coming away thinking that she is not someone we want with us on our side, helping us see. You know, I mean, I can't imagine, and I really want to believe that the, you know, leaders of the church are good men trying to do the honorable thing, and that if they had time, if there were, you know, if there were world enough and time to take account of all these varying perspectives and somehow, you know, meet people and understand them heart to heart, that things would look different. But there isn't, you know, there's the problem of trying to scale up a Christian ministry to millions of people. And, you know, I am sure glad that I don't have to figure out that problem. I wouldn't begin to know how to do it. So, you know, I don't know how much calculation there is. I don't find that implausible, and it certainly worked, right? I mean, in 1993, they shut things down. for a while, to the point, you know, as I think Peggy said in her article, or somebody said recently, that, you know, in 2004, Peggy published a piece that said, "Where is Mormon feminism gone?" Because the 1993 action had been so effective in scaring feminists into leaving or shutting up. I think it's less likely to have that effect now because of social media. There's just, you know, in 1993, it was the readers of Dialogue and Exponent and Sunstone and the really hardcore Mormon geeks who were paying very close attention.
Go geeks!
You know, yay geeks! But, you know, there weren't that many. I remember at the time saying, you know, if they just didn't get any of these people in the newspaper, you know, there would be fewer than 5,000 Mormons who'd ever heard of any of them, you know, let alone been swayed by their teachings. Like, so, but but I was wrong then, you know, in thinking that the publicity would be more costly than the ideas. The publicity ended up not really costing the church all that much institutionally. I mean, of course, if you count the loss in human pain and, you know, if you're a believer in souls lost forever, it's devastating. But institutionally, there was not a high price to pay.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I was chatting with Albert Peck. I've already released one with him this morning and talking about this sort of stuff. And then afterwards, he sent me an email and he says, you know, one of the differences between 93 and today is in 93, it was pretty much people publishing their ideas, and it seemed to be the ideas that they were cracking on, where perhaps with the two, especially, you know, Kate and John right now, it's more their activism than their ideas. Do you sense that there's something there, that it's the embodied action, it's the people who now get together, who galvanize in these, you know, extra conferences or these, you know, embodied, you know, actions at Temple Square and things like that? Do you think that's maybe the bigger issue now than just ideas, you know, are out there, but activism is what gets the news?
Maybe. I don't think they're comfortable with any of these.
Yeah, they don't like those either. Yeah.
But I think it has to do with publication, I think, and press attention.
And this, by this, we also mean blogs with big reach, podcasts with big reach. We don't mean it has to be in print. Though I know you and I favor
Right, right. I do think it's not just in print. I mean, I think they're looking at, I think it's a question of scale, right?
How big's your platform?
I think it's not so much the platform as the scale. So in 1993, Dialogue and Sunstone were sort of it in terms of media that were paying close attention to ideas about Mormonism, right? And the 1993 actions combined with the talk about alternate voices succeeded in cutting those audiences. I don't know about Sunstone, but for Dialogue, it was roughly in half. And I suspect similar for Sunstone.
Mm-hmm.
That the numbers matter to them. And now, you know, blogs get some, but blogs are kind of ephemeral. But darn it, when those feminists are getting the front page of the New York Times, you know, then we're talking about the kind of reach that matters. And so I think it's ideas that get enough traction to be heard outside the Mormon world.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe.
Mm-hmm. Good. Good thoughts. Yeah.
And it was, I mean, that's not completely dissimilar from 1993. I mean, talking about Heavenly Mother, you know, was enough to get the attention of people who were interested in feminist theology, or talking about abuse in the church. Certainly, you know, there was some national attention to those issues at the time. And so it was ideas that somehow connect with something bigger in the zeitgeist and potentially air the church's dirty laundry in one way or another.
Well, thank you, my friend. Anything else that's on your brain to share here in this quick download?
No, just that this is hard and sad, but, well, here's the last thing that I want to tell you. At the same time as I got, like, literally one on top of each other, the email from Jody Cantor with a link to her story, And just after that came an email from my Relief Society president explaining the situation of a family that are not members of our church but live in our ward and have some connections to members of the church, and had just had a baby and a terribly rough birth, and the mother's still recuperating, and she was wondering if we could bring some meals. And within about an hour, there were a month's worth of meals arranged and rides to doctors and, you know, care for the infant, and, you know, people just so eager to help. And it was so comforting to me that, you know, at the same time as Mormons are behaving in these horrible, you know, small, petty ways, the same sort of pragmatic attention to detail and structure that gets us into trouble also makes it possible for us to be better than any one person is by themselves. And I'm heartbroken that we're all human and struggling through this together. But I also think that's the only way that there is to do it. You know, if there were a better way, we would find it. And I'm just not sure there is.
Yeah. So worth preserving this community, worth preserving this church. And it just, when you see the beautiful things, it just makes this stand in such great stark contrast. I don't know. Is that kind of a point you're making? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's not only that, you know, it's not that Mormon people are good and the institution is bad. It's
right.
That the institution makes both this goodness and beauty and this sad.
Beautiful. Yes.
Painful thing. It facilitates both. It is one of those terrible things of pied beauty that Gerard Manley Hopkins talks about, you know, that everything is and foul and freckled and shot through with the grandeur of God.
Gorgeous. Thank you so much, my friend.
You're welcome.
We'll talk to you again soon, and anytime that you change your mind on any of this, call me back or blog in the comments and stuff, but you're the best.
I will.
Appreciate you.
All right. Carry on.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.